International Diplomatic Student Association is Hungary-based student organization for university students interested in political science, multilateral treaties, and intergovernmental relations. IDSA podcast aims to educate its listeners on career opportunities to university students in Hungary, opening their minds to pressing social and geopolitical issues. The podcast is recorded with the support of EPR Radio.
Today's IDSA podcast guest speaker is Balázs Mártonfi, who is a political scientist currently serving as the director of the American Studies Research Institute in Budapest and a non-resident fellow at the International Center for Security and Leadership in Colorado. He previously was an assistant professor of security studies at Ludovica, University of Public Service. Balázs lectures at the Hungarian Diplomatic Academy and the European Security and Defense College. He has taught at George Washington University and American University, and was a visiting researcher at the U.S. Air Force Academy. He has worked in the foreign and defense ministries. Balázs, these titles and accomplishments speak for themselves. I'm sure that many students would like to have such a colorful CV and career path in the future as yours. But let's start from the beginning. Did you always see yourself working in the field of international politics?
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to the members of the International Diplomatic Student Association. And welcome, Reka, and welcome, Teresa. That's a very interesting question. You mentioned multiple times that the profile, after that very generous introduction, that my CV is colorful. Yes, on the one hand, if we look at it sort of item by item, you may see that they are a mosaic or a kaleidoscope. But there is a connecting theme, and the connecting theme was always my interest in security. As a young individual going through high school, I didn't quite know that this was international politics slash international security what interested me, but mainly the issues of war and peace. And as a young student, what really drew me was the study of history, and history in the sense that it was a study of politics, right? I didn't quite know how to phrase it, so I was always drawn towards history, which is why my initial degree, my bachelor's degree, is in history, in fact. And only after going through the first couple of years of college did it really dawn on me that while history is an extremely interesting topic, history is not really written by historian. It is written about by historian. And that sort of distinction drew me closer towards what you call international politics and what I call the study of international politics or political science, and specifically the relationship between nation states as political entities. So that was the switch to the sort of the international security aspect of my career, going on from Washington University in St. Louis, where I did my undergraduate studies, to the University of Denver, to the Corbell School of International Studies, where I had a great opportunity to be exposed to a number of different theoretical and practical and policy aspects of the of similar questions. So under the tutelage of Deborah Avant, currently the president of the International Student International Studies Association, and Rachel Epstein, a great scholar of NATO, I had the opportunity to look at some of these cross-cutting issues that, broadly speaking, fit under the theme of international politics, but have very divergent views as to what makes that up. And that's where really the angle of understanding politics requires not just an academic experience dawned on me. And then I joined the defense ministry, and later on the foreign ministry, did an internship at NATO, all throughout working on this larger security theme. So the kaleidoscope that you see on my CV, and again, very generous introduction, thank you so much, has this connecting thread, which I really enjoyed looking through it. So I have the luxury of working every day, but it doesn't feel working. I like it. I'm interested. I always love exploring questions, looking at it from all these different angles, and not just from sort of the abstract game theoretical or empirical studies or let's run that linear regression model on large data sets sort of view, but also having gone through it as, you know, in the foreign ministry and the defense ministry is sort of the day-to-day politics of what these large questions mean in the policy decision-making world. So overall, I've been very blessed. I had great mentors along the way, great opportunities, but some of the things that stay with me are the interactions I had specifically through my undergraduate, master's, and doctoral studies with fellow students back when you have the time to think about why does the world work that way? And you're less interested in, well, let's keep the world working the same way, which is in my interest. So those are always great times.
And why did you choose to specialize on international security issues?
Mainly because there had to be some connecting theme. International politics, broadly speaking, is anything from climate change, which if you listen to Anthony Blinken or looked at the interim national security strategic guidance by Joe Biden issued on March 3rd, has become a securitized or at least partially securitized issue. It's a very divergent field from elections in Ghana to why did the U.S. withdraw embassy staff from Chad to all these different sorts of questions, the Brazilian elections. It was way too broad for me to grapple with. My mind capacity is limited as well, just like everyone else's. So I had to pick something which was of interest. And growing up and just throughout my life, it has always been the questions of war and peace, broadly speaking. So when I stumbled upon the international security master's program at the Corbell School, that's when I knew, hey, that's really what is of interest to me. When that happened, I was actually in Brussels on a visiting scholarship. I was at the Vrije Universiteit Brussel, a nice Dutch term. The Free University of Brussels, or more commonly known in Hungary with the ULB, the French name for it. And I was doing an internship with a EU security company working on EU regulations that was affecting the field of security. And that's when it all clicked. I was like, hey, this is so interesting. I'm a Hungarian, but educated in the US. NATO, that sort of fits the profile, that it all makes sense, security, and that's where this NATO focus, which if you look at my CV from that point on, really connects all the dots. Sort of, you know, broadly speaking, transatlantic alliance, values, but there's also lots of interests, how the two interact, and how we can work towards something that's broadly speaking good in the world. And that's not the political scientist in me speaking, that's the individual in me saying that, yeah, NATO is sort of a force for good, if you want to call it that. Obviously, we can dissect it from a political science-y standpoint, which my dissertation did, and it took quite a while to write, so have all that things we can talk about. But generally speaking, that's the reason I chose international security. Fundamentally, there's this question of how should, you know, if you We're in the period of human history, if I may be so fanciful and philosophical, when we have the luxury of, most of us have the luxury of, at least part of us, depending on how you define your own society and circle, have the luxury of grappling with questions of, what do I want to do with my life? And for me, assisting in this very indirect way of helping people do that, by trying to figure out why do wars happen and why does conflict happen, and obviously the solutions to those questions hopefully get integrated back into policy, thinking about how to avoid those things. Net results, sort of, you know, four or five steps down the way, of people having the chance of figuring out what they want to do with their lives. So this is sort of a long and circumstanced answer to, I really didn't like studying about World War II. And I thought, hey, nuclear weapons, stability, NATO, stability, liberal world order, seems like it's working, or the number of different questions, but I am a constructo realist political scientist, so there's sort of obviously questions down the line as to why it functions the way it functions. But that's the personal motivation, and that's sort of the connecting thread of international security, NATO, all throughout.
Can you introduce your background and how it affected your professional pathway?
The NATO focus I can elaborate on, obviously. So after my master's degree at the Corbell School, I was a visiting researcher at the U.S. Air Force Academy, and I had the luxury of teaching a couple of classes on nuclear proliferation and NATO. And how the two combine is obviously the tactical nuclear weapons through the NATO Nuclear Sharing Agreement, which is a very weird thing if you think about it, because you have six European states holding U.S. nuclear weapons without actually having control over the nuclear weapons, right? They're still in U.S. hands, and this is when the whole politics angle really kicked in when it says the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, this big treaty which governs nuclear stability in the world, limits nuclear weapon states and denies them the opportunity to give nuclear weapons over to nuclear non-weapon states. Now, NATO Nuclear Sharing Agreement, which is where this all really clicked for me, says, hey, yes, the Americans have the weapons. They're just on European soil, stored on European bases, but they're in fact in American hands. And when I asked my professor, okay, but deterrence works by the threat of you using these weapons, then they said, oh, yeah, yeah, by the way, if and when it comes to war, the U.S.'s official position is that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is null and void in war. And I'm like, huh, that's an interesting deterrence concept. And that drew me to, okay, well, I really am interested in this dynamic, studying security from a NATO angle, something to do with nuclear stuff. And that's how I applied for the internship program at NATO. NATO headquarters in Brussels, the defense policy and planning division, best experience of my life. I can just suggest everyone should apply for that program. It's very selective and a number of different attributes and contributing factors come into the selection process. But yeah, phenomenal time, learned an insane amount. They draw you into how does decision making work. Both from a national and international and sort of an international organization, an intergovernmental organization angle. And after the internship in NATO, I knew that, hey, this is something I'm really interested in pursuing, both on the policy and sort of the academic side. And I met with then Ambassador István Kovács, who was the Hungarian ambassador to NATO, and he suggested, hey, you seem to be a promising young student, I think were his words, or young intern, I think that was the exact phraseology. And I apologize, Ambassador, if I messed that up over here, if you by any chance are listening. And he suggested, why don't I shift over and work for the Hungarian Defense Policy Department? And that's when I said, okay, it's like a pretty good idea. I sat over, did policy work, so actual policy stuff on NATO as the NATO desk officer in the defense ministry. And after about a year or so, I sort of said, and again, this is the youthful me saying that, I looking back, and probably even then I knew that obviously there was only limits to my understanding of how the decision making of the defense ministry and the broader Hungarian political elite worked. But I sort of said, hey, I sort of understand how the national interest is defined. And I sort of have an understanding of how policy works, both the political angle, the non-political angle, the multi-stakeholder approach, all that different stuff in Hungary. But I still see certain policies that Hungary wants to get done in NATO, which don't come to fruition. And now, some other policies that, for example, the U.S. wants to get done. And sometimes it can get its way and sometimes it can't. And this puzzled me all throughout. And that's when I was like, okay, that's a really interesting question. Why is it that sometimes NATO as an alliance is cohesive and sometimes it is incohesive? And I thought, I want to spend a couple years of my life, I didn't quite know what I was getting into back then, studying this in depth. And that's when I applied for my doctoral program. I knew Washington would be a pretty good place to do that. And I read back in the day a piece by Ivo Dalter, who was the then ambassador to NATO by the United States, and his co-author, a professor by the name of Jim Goldgeier, who published a piece on global NATO. And I was like, that's a really interesting concept. So I looked up James Goldgeier. He was at American University in Washington, D.C. I looked up Ivo Dalter. He was in an actual government policy position. I was like, okay, so that Jim Goldgeier looks like a pretty solid guy. I like the way he thinks. Applied to the doctoral program at American University School of International Service. He was then the dean. And it's a political science doctoral program, but we can bore the the listeners on the details of that. But anyhow, it took 5 years, but I sort of found the answer to that question. And Jim Goldgeier was part of my committee, was an integral part of that. Found the answer to the solution with this sort of novel idea of studying alliance cohesion through statistical models, lots of archival work, which I have to mention because it took ages to do, and it's really hard work. And be nice to the archivists. I can only, very important suggestion. Be nice to the archivists. So I wrote the doctoral dissertation and sort of answered the puzzle with this idea of separating threat perception into general and specific, which was fairly well received by the academic community when the year after I won the John McCain Award by the Munich Security Conference. And interestingly, so I'm a constructo realist scholar, but the head of the committee was Andrew Moravchik from Princeton, a liberal scholar on in the political science international relations aspect. But he also thought that was a well done sort of, you know, good job, and it's an important scientific advancement. And again, I solved that puzzle, and the next step was, hey, great. Okay, what to do next? And I had the luxury of meeting a couple of people from the Hungarian Foreign Ministry who were out visiting D.C. And then later on in Hungary, and they said, hey, NATO, you seem to know what you're writing about. You have some experience with the internship at NATO and the defense ministry. Don't you want to come sort of work for us? And so that was a hard transition because I was already an assistant professor of security studies at Ludovica, which I loved a lot. Love that institution. It sort of fits my personal interest of policy plus education plus training plus international relations in a very nice sort of Venn diagram overlap, if I can call it that, which is the University of Public Service. I just call it Ludovica because that's the former Royal Military Academy name. And it's a little easier on the tongue than the University of Public Service. Apologies. And then I sort of gave up my assistant professor position and joined the Foreign Ministry as the Deputy Director for Security Policy and head of the NATO unit, and did that for a year. Very interesting stuff. Perhaps one of the most interesting moments over there was when I got a phone call from the U.S. Embassy saying that they would like to meet. My boss was out of town, so they called me instead of my boss. And I told them, yeah, sure, call the secretariat and we'll set up a meeting. And they're like, no, as we would like to meet today. I'm like, okay, is that 11 a.m., 4 p.m.? No, we are en route. We would like to meet now. And I'm like, okay, come on in. And it was the day before they announced that the U.S. would withdraw from the Open Skies Treaty. I will let our listeners figure out why they wanted to meet at that time. And I think this way I'm sort of safe on any sort of interaction portion of this, which may get into diplomatically challenging acquiescence issues. But that was sort of a nice moment to be part of something. And Hungary, as the co-depositary of the Open Skies Treaty, was notified as a NATO member as well. So it was interesting to see history in the making. And I'm sure you've all followed the Trump administration's decision to withdraw from that and sort of the broader JCPOA withdrawal, climate agreement withdrawal, sort of their idea of how to approach multilateralism. So it was nice to be part of foreign policy, security policy decision-making from the Hungarian Foreign Ministry, which then led to the current position I'm in, where I'm the director of the Institute for American Studies at Ludovica, which is a research institute, but sort of on the policy research-oriented research institute, where we look at the United States not just as a hegemon who runs the global system, but also as a nation state which functions in certain ways, and there's sort of certain guiding principles as to what it does, and we try to look at how and what Hungary can do in response to the hegemonic pushes and shoves as its own nation state with its own national interests. So, for example, the latest project we're working on is a book called Collision Courses, properly, where we look at the U.S.-China great power competition and break it down into 11 sectors: technology, energy, economics, great power competition, traditional view of it, and look at how that competition between the established hegemon and the rising hegemon is looking to shape up, and what sort of possibilities does Hungary have to promote its own national interest in this great power competition. So that's a book project which I'm really interested in and we're working on now. And I hope that answers your question. That was sort of a longer statement on how the dots connect in my CV and how my thinking, I'm not sure evolved is the correct way, although that's a whole other topic as to whether thinking evolves or whether our understanding of thinking evolves or whether our understanding of the perception of thinking evolves. But anyhow, so that sort of connects the dots over there.
So as you mentioned, you won the John McCain Dissertation Award in 2020, recognizing exceptional research in transatlantic relations by the Munich Security Conference, and 2019 William C. Olson Award, recognizing exceptional teaching by the American University School of International Service. Can you elaborate on these awards? And do you consider these wins an inspiration for other young Hungarians being interested in security issues?
So I briefly touched upon the John McCain Award by the Munich Security Conference. I think, so they started that a couple of years ago, obviously in legacy of the late John McCain, who was, without any sort of political stances, was a giant in his field. And I think he was well respected on both sides of the political aisle in the United States. And he was the initial American, and, you know, sort of he was a POW, war vet, all that different stuff, who said, hey, we have to work with Europe. Sort of the transatlantic relationship is extremely important. And he figured out that that sort of meant Germany. And I'm not, you know, probably not giving you too much away over here, that Germany and the German-U.S. relationship is exceedingly important when it comes to the transatlantic alliance. And he started going over to the Munich Security Conference year by year, and he started bringing his fellow congressmen, and then he started bringing fellow administration officials, and he said, hey, this is a great idea. We have to keep the floor of dialogue open. We have to maintain a platform where we can talk about stuff, where we share global understanding of what values we as nation states should work towards, and this should be the venue where we discuss it. And the Munich Security Conference, after the decease of the late John McCain, decided that this spirit of studying the transatlantic relationship and trying to figure out why it works, why it doesn't, and obviously why it doesn't, the goal is, okay, if it doesn't, then how could it work better, should be recognized with this dissertation award, recognizing exceptional research on transatlantic relations. So I was deeply honored when I was not notified by Wolfgang Gischinger, the head of the Munich Security Conference, Ambassador Wolfgang Gischinger, that I was recognized by this award. Deeply honored. On the one sense, it's finishing a doctorate is reward in and of itself. The intellectual exercise and rigor you go through, the journey is worth it even without the destination, and the journey is worth it even without the recognition of the destination. But obviously, yes, it was a huge, huge and deeply privileging moment to be able to receive this award. I didn't know that I had a shot for this award. I knew the dissertation was good. The committee was, you know, everyone was very happy. They invited Andrew Bennett of Georgetown to be the external reader, which I sort of was shocked. I was like, no. This is good enough. It's good enough. And they're like, no, this is good. So great comments. Thank you. And it made it even better. But I think, fundamentally speaking, the award that is much less recognized but means much more to me is the second award you bring up, the William C. Olson Award for Exceptional Teaching by a PhD student who recognizes the former dean of the School of International Service, who was devoted to teaching. And I think part of the job we do as academics is not just to work on scientific advancements which benefit no one, and again, I know this sentence is contentious, so by no one I mean it takes years and years for that scientific benefit to go into policy making to get a better understanding of how notable terms now like threat perception or the boomerang effect or multilateral cooperation or deterrence, these concepts go into policy making. But I was always on the side of you have to teach when you research, and the things you teach should be incorporated into the best advancements of the students. And that award was recognized that I enjoyed teaching, I liked teaching, and I put a fair amount of effort into teaching. Understanding how to connect with the students, using Game of Thrones examples to illustrate how realism works, looking at popular Netflix shows, which, well, I double-dipped there. I can safely say that, yes, absolutely, it was for the benefit of the students so I can better explain certain IR paradigms, but it was also a nice little relaxing thing to do when I wasn't working on my dissertation. So that award was very nice. I do very much enjoy teaching. I love teaching the students at the Hungarian Diplomatic Academy, which is a phenomenal venture, which was started by a previous speaker here at the podcast, State Secretary Bacsai Tomasits Orsolya. And I think that's a phenomenal idea. It is very important to train the next generation of Hungarian diplomats to have a good understanding of how the world works. And it's really hard to provide an objective understanding of how the world works. So what I do in my classes in that diplomatic academy is to provide multiple understanding of what claim to be objective representations of how the world works, sort of what you would call ontologies. And I don't know whether I'm allowed to use that in this podcast, but yeah, ontologies and epistemologies and thinking communities about how the national interest is defined, whether that concept exists, and how that all works, and what a foreign ministry and the end appendages of the foreign ministries, diplomats out in host institutions and host countries can do. So teaching is always, I've really enjoyed it. I still do it now in my institute director position. I teach at Diplomatic Academy and at Ludovica, and I think it's at least partially a calling slash vocation which comes to it, which having transitioned back to the Hungarian reality, I hope is given a little more attention in priorities as well, because I think it's very important, and it's important to look at students as not just tabula rasa, where I paint my own understanding of the world, but sort of as individuals who have their own thinking, and my job as an instructor or a teacher is to help them understand why their thinking works that way and how other people's thinking work and what the end results of that are.
Thank you. So the next question is that what can we as individuals do to understand security issues better and to make it a well-liked subject in our everyday lives, besides watching Netflix and Game of Thrones, of course?
Well, that's a great question, Reka. Thank you. I think security is everywhere, right? The question becomes what you define as security. Is it just the freedom from having to do things you don't want to do? Is it survival? Is it stability? How those concepts interrelate or what they do? But I think if we turn from the sort of the broad metaphorical understanding of the Waltzian concept of the stability of the bipolar world and all that stuff, which I'm absolutely certain your professors make you read. I think on a day-to-day basis, there's only one suggestion what I have, and I know this may not be too popular, but it's think, read, and think. And think about what you want to read and how you will read stuff which you don't want to read. Then read all that stuff and then think about what you read. So I personally, and I think I can safely share this given that this is a U.S. example, back when Obama was president, I was subscribed to the White House Daily Brief, read their version of the story, and then always read the National Interest or Slate or the other leaning security-related or at least security tangentially related issues of how to perceive security topics. When President Trump, I did just the opposite, listened to the official communication of the White House and read Vox and the liberal-leaning versions of the story. Because politics is politics. You know, democracy has its own rule of politics, but you still have to understand that there are power concentrations between the parties who are interested in at least guiding the narrative. And I think from an academic freedom standpoint, and freedom is not quite the same as independence, and it's not quite the same as self-sufficiency or autarky. So we use the term freedom sort of co-equally, but they're nuanced and important nuances between the four. But I think as a political scientist and as an educator, and that's a very broad term, so I use it only in the smaller portion of that, I think my job is to read and understand information and why the information is persist in that way, what the biases are, understand the biases, and still think about it. It may be daunting at first because if you just start reading about, say, the Azeri-Armenian conflict, and let's just leave it at that, right? You sort of get narratives on certain senses, and then the more you dig into it, the more you realize that there's certain guiding dynamics behind the narratives. You certain realize that, it is pretty hard to differentiate between good and bad guys in any political situation. But the fundamental challenge, and I think this is what each individual has to go through, is this learning curve of, I believe in good and evil. I realize that people have interests which push me towards that belief, whether that's well-founded or not. But fundamentally, if you want to function, and these are just my own personal thoughts, you have to put your values somewhere, because life without values is a cynic. And, you know, very simple cynic approach. And again, we're getting into philosophy, and I'm sure my undergraduate philosophy professor would chide me for, no, you're mixing that up. That's not quite the cynic. It's the neo-cynics. And if there was that. And but I think it's important to a liberal arts education, I think, is generally important over there. But fundamentally, you have to believe in some values if you want to live a happy life. And I have the luxury of, you know, leading the American Studies Research Institute, where we deal with the U.S. and in their Declaration of Independence, it says, you know, the pursuit of happiness. And that is, it's somewhat unique in as far as constitutions and declarations of independence go, as founding documents go, that it says, hey, you have the right to, inalienable right to the pursuit of happiness. But I hope, and, you know, obviously it's very hard to draw any parallels between states, because states as political entities have monopolized the legitimate use of violence, if I remember my Max Weber right. So they have the power to guide certain narratives of what happens and what doesn't happen. But I think fundamentally for individuals, for us to be able to think today, when I said, hey, I would love to come to this podcast, this is a great idea, you should be doing this, happy to do this. I'm not working on my publication, I'm not working on all the other stuff I should be working on. But I think you have to pick projects and things in your life which you attach value to. You have to be really cognizant of why you do that, but fundamentally, that's the end point. So I think security, for me, I'm not sure I would push students towards, hey, look at security. I think just similarly to economics and similarly to philosophy, there are certain subjects that it's very useful for most students who go through what we call tertiary education, college or university, to be broadly speaking aware of, specifically the debates over there. And not necessarily because the debates themselves are so meaningful, but the structure and typology of the debates can then be seen to be replicated in other kind of debates. Liberal, conservative, far right, far left, center, what these things mean, what we mean about climate change, why is geoengineering so contentious. So the debates fundamentally between Epicureans and Stoics, if we go that far back, or are these different themes, there's certain Locke versus Rousseau, there's certain themes you can pick up and it helps evolve your thinking. Now, granted, I'm a political scientist, and most scientists would say, there are two value judgments you have to believe in if you want to be a scientist. One is, it is better, whatever that may mean, to think than not to think. And the second, it's better to think systematically than not to think systematically. But those are value judgments which I ascribe to. So I think, back to your original question, if security doesn't interest you, then I still think it's useful for you to get a general understanding of the driving motives behind weapons, military, defense ministries, foreign ministries. Why is it that sometimes conflicts flare up? Why is it that Russia uses military exercises to signal? Do they use it to signal to Ukraine, their own domestic population? Does it have to do with domestic politics? Is it all a larger game of, ooh, there's also an OPEC meeting going on? So I think it's important to be aware of how all these things interconnect. But I think security is something that I'm interested in, and we have had the luxury, and as a person in my mid-30s, I can say that I've had the luxury of not having to deal with these issues living in Hungary, living in the U.S., living in Europe, whole, free, and at peace, whatever that may mean, not have to deal with it on my personal thing. But my parents had to. My grandparents had to. I truly wish we can work towards instances where we avoid conflict. So in that sense, if you're interested in climate change, great. Learn about that. Read about that. Understand why it is securitized. Yeah, you can always see that at least someone has securitized some topic in some way. So generally, think, read, think is the final takeaway I'd say to that.
Let's talk a little bit about our region. So what do you think, what are the biggest security threats that we are facing in Hungary and as well as in Europe?
Oh, okay. That's a tough one. Biggest security threats in Hungary and in Europe. So I think broadly speaking, the largest threat the international system is facing is the U.S. as a hegemon in rising China, and what Graham Allison and Harvard's Belfer Center have very creatively typologized as the Thucydides trap. In human history, we've observed 16 instances where an established hegemon was confronted with a rising hegemon. The most well-known or famous of this, of course, is Thucydides' describal of the Peloponnesian War, an established Sparta, rising Athens. And the question becomes, how can you avoid conflict? And in this study, in the 16 instances where there was an established rising hegemon, and the power structures and incentives were clear that there was a shift in the power dynamic, out of the 16 instances, in only 4 could we, broadly speaking, we, as in the global society, avoid war. So in 12 of the instances, it was war. I would personally prefer if we avoided that. But, you know, there are the Rockefellers who said when there's blood on the streets, buy property. So I'm not saying there's always winners and losers in wars, even on the winning side, and most definitely on the losing side. But I think that's the largest security challenge. And just like the Trump administration, the Biden administration will be consistent in that policy that they will be pushing is too strong of a word initially, but slowly inching their way towards asking their European allies in NATO, at least, to pick sides and sort of figure out, hey, you have been under the US-led liberal order with benefits X, Y, and Z. And they will also have to work on presenting that those benefits will continue and outweigh whatever benefits a different system would bring. So I think that's sort of the largest globalized or international, depending, and obviously these terms by themselves are loaded, so we can get into why I use those words. But let's just say the international system, the largest security threat for Europe as well, is how the U.S. and China manage the relationship. Can China be co-opted into the international system? Will we see a form of neo-containment, right? When we saw the Soviet-U.S. rivalry back not that long ago, but, you know, in historical terms, obviously for a 35-year-old or 33-year-old, it is that long ago. But that's the broader threat. On the sort of more topical issues here, a number of different things can be picked up depending on how you define security. Do you mean regime security? Do you mean state security? Do you mean human security, family security? All these different questions over here. I think energy has become an increasingly interesting issue of how it interrelates with the question of security. But I think sort of global trends on energy diversification, both on the domestic political angle, the national political angle, and the regional political angle, is going towards a more stable mix because you have more options. So I think that sense, security could be increasing. Topically, obviously, the question of Ukraine, and we just saw the 100,000 Russian troops part of the exercise, is at least partially a form of brinksmanship, which usually potentially could lead to miscalculation, which is obviously something that I personally would like to avoid. On the nuclear stability front, with the renewal of the New START treaty, which was renewed early February for another 5 years, which is sort of the strategic stability, nuclear weapons question of both Russia and the U.S. Maintained their arsenal of a nuclear triad of, I think, 1760 total delivery vehicles combined. That's sort of a what most people would say a stable or a stabilizing factor on the international security environment. But some of the very valid criticisms that President Donald Trump brought into the question was that China was not part of that. And China's nuclear modernization is lacks transparency, if I may say so myself. So there's a definite difference between expert assessment of Chinese modernization programs, and even though they currently, at least publicly, state a no first use policy and state that they adhere to minimal deterrence with roughly 300 nuclear weapons. And if you bring that up to or sort of compare that to the 1760 U.S. per Russian numbers, in addition to the deactivated, unactivated, non-deployed, non-strategic or tactical nuclear weapons, which are multiple thousands in the Russian front and a couple of hundred in the U.S. front, then you sort of get into the issue of there's a potential for miscalculation if transparency is not maintained. So I think, broadly speaking, arms control regimes like the New START is a definite stabilizing factor. And I think that debate on the intellectual front, which was Scott Sagan versus Kenneth Waltz, on that end sort of has been settled. But if you look at, you know, bringing or continuing this nuclear angle, the future of the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Iran up to 60% uranium enrichment, Fordow Natanz, we saw the recent alleged Israeli attack. Obviously, I wasn't there, so I don't know. But there seems to be some sort of political logic as to why that would make sense, but understandably so. I mean, the Middle East is and has been a global hotspot. I mean, I'm not saying anything new over there, so that's definitely there. I think things which we would not have talked about 20 years ago would be reassertive Russia, rise of China. We would still have spoken about Japan. I would say the Arctic is definitely something which is has all the potential fiats and features of a conflict that could flare up anytime soon, and we don't talk about it enough. And climate-related issues, right? Because climate change in and of itself is maybe a catalyst for it, or a securitizing issue. Yes, broadly speaking, were we in competition with the Martians, then yes, different question, but we're not really in competition with the Martians. We're in competition with each other here on this planet. So, no, again, very long answer to a very pointed question, but I think that sort of runs the gamut. And I haven't spoken about terrorism, migration, also all important, partially or somewhat security policy questions. And water security, food security. So, you know, we were on the gamut. If you're interested, there's lots of stuff to read out there and lots of stuff to think about.
So since we are arriving to the end of our podcast, our last topic is in connection with NATO and the 2% of the GDP contribution debate, which is an issue that the Trump presidency heavily advocated for. And after 100 days of the Biden presidency, what are your views? Is this something that remains on the table of the U.S. government?
Yes. Yes, obviously it remains on the table. The question is it the centerpiece? Is it the side piece? Or is it the far off to the left piece, which I know is on the table, but I have so many other stuff to work with, I don't get to it. So is it agenda item number 1, 2, 3, or 17? Broadly speaking, the whole 2% debate, and I'll try to be very brief because I know time's running out, is a policy strategy, politics, foreign policy, domestic politics, intergovernmental view mismatch, fundamentally speaking. Because the 2% guideline and then political pledge later on at the Wells Summit is an easy term where you can wrap your head around. Are you a free rider in the NATO security regime, or are you a solid ally where you contribute enough? But obviously the debate is much more complex than that. Let's just start with the U.S. angle on it. The U.S. GDP defense budget is $760 billion, depending on whether Biden gets what he asks from Congress this time around. But it's, let's say, 3.5% of their GDP, roughly speaking, goes on defense. Now, how much of that is devoted to NATO? The U.S. is a global actor. They have multiple military stations around the world, Okinawa, security commitments ranging from the Far East to the Southeast Asia to the Middle East. So fundamentally speaking, it gets into really interesting questions of how much of that is even devoted to NATO if it comes to that. Now, the Estonians, you would most likely say that most of their defense budget is directly into NATO. But back to the larger question, is 2% a good metric to measure anything? No, but it's a readily communicable one. Because even people who don't deal with the intricacies of burden sharing, and I'll get into the intricacies of burden sharing in just a few sentences right after, understand that 2% good, less than 2% bad, right? Simple metric. It says on the prima facie, that on the first reading of it, it seems like a fair way of looking at whether you're contributing enough to the collective defense, right? If you want to call it that, of NATO. But obviously, this is a much more complex issue, because when the 2% issue was brought up for, say, the German public, the German defense minister at the time simply said, hey, sure, I'll just double the pay of all the soldiers in the defense force and we'll get to 2%. Is there any actual value that goes into it other than for the individuals who can then buy nicer houses and, I don't know, all that different stuff? Probably not, broadly speaking, right? So there's certain different, more nuanced and more refined ways of understanding what an alliance contribution metric looks like. In one of my previous writings with Garrett Martin, we looked at an alliance contribution metric, which looked at, you would incorporate the type of weapons, how far you are from conflict, the amount of money you put into partnerships, the amount of political capital to use to promote NATO, as sort of a complex view of understanding what 2% does in a too simple, not simplistic, but too simple way of understanding it, which was a great academic exercise, but it wouldn't get past the first layer of politics because it's 17 pages long. And you're like, okay, no, that's way too complex. It doesn't work. NATO works on input and output metrics as well, looking at what the alliance promises in and promises out. So the 2% debate, fundamentally, again, easy political tool to communicate good from bad. And again, in most people like to think that there's good and bad international politics, and you know, realist scholars would tell you that's not quite what the case really is. So easy political tool masks a complexity which needs to be studied, but only, you know, devoted students of security studies get there to really study that. Is it going away? Probably the method of communication from the Biden administration on looking to get allies to spend 2% will change. That means probably less tweets and more demarches. But fundamentally, the U.S. president is also in a tough spot, or in a political impetus, or faces political impeti about selling the NATO alliance back to the public. And it's a lot easier sell if he can say, hey, everyone else is also spending 2%. That's a good thing. We're there. We have troops there. The U.S. by itself provides the broader nuclear stability angle. And interestingly, it sort of varied between presidents, this question of burden sharing and 2%. I personally, I think sort of this ties up to my initial comments and sort of segues into the end of our podcast, is the question becomes, to answer your question, is how does the U.S. deal with China? And how large of a role do they want NATO to play in the U.S.-China dynamic? If it's large, then I would expect, in addition to, and we can talk about some riskier topics like 5G and all that different stuff, but 2% will be, hey, that's the way to do it. That was a joint idea of 2% is a good thing. You should be doing that because China is a security threat. If it's both an opportunity and a threat, then we get into interesting topics. But I think it'll be something we can revert back to in a couple of months.
Thank you for being our guest speaker at IDSA Podcast. This was the last episode this semester. And today's guest speaker was Balázs Mártonfi, and we talked about current international security issues.
Thank you for being here, and best of luck and enjoy the summer.
Thank you.